Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome to the program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The war is going on. There's no doubt about it. The war is going on. Which war is the war against Christmas, of course. Who's waging it? Exxon Mobil. Yep. Open Arctic Sea. Santa Claus is going to lose his home. Here's the bottom. Yes. Anecdotally, peripherally, the Christmas trees are going back at SeaTac Airport, the Seattle Airport. The holiday trees. And, in fact, I have a little information about the history of holiday trees. I remember this digression here, and then we'll get to what's actually going to happen to Santa Claus's home and the real war on Christmas, which is the war on the Arctic. But I remember we lived in Germany back in 1986, 87. And in this little town out in the middle of nowhere, Stadtsteinach, in the Frankenwald, in the northern Bavaria, right up against the East German and the Czech borders, in the mountains, in the low mountains. And at Christmas time, we would go out. Herr Müller, the kind of wise elder of the community, he would go out in the forest and find a tree, and they lit up this tree. I mean, they literally clipped candles to it. And lit up this tree, and a couple of the kids would go out and they'd play music, and Herr Müller would bring the horses, his horse and some of the other horses, and there was a goat there and the dogs and the cats and whatnot, and bring the animals and then the kids, and we would all have to find the tree. We'd all tromp through the snow until we found the tree, and then we'd gather around the tree and Herr Müller would read from the Bible. And that was Christmas. It was really cool. It was really very, very sweet. And I remember, hearing the story of how did the Christmas tree come about. You know, this is an old German thing that became an Anglo thing, that became an American thing. And it really goes back a couple thousand years. It goes back even before what you might call the pagan times, which is more of an English thing. And that was that way back when, the priests figured out that, and this is, they have these calendar stones that are thousands of years old, you know, the Stonehenge kind of stones. In fact, there are some, oddly enough, there are some in North America that seem to date back to around the time of Leif Erikson, and maybe even before that. There's over 200 of these things just in New Hampshire. We used to live in New Hampshire. These calendar stones that they found, that they, no idea, I mean, these things have been here for thousands of years. But in any case, they had these calendar stones that would tell them when winter would end, when the winter solstice was, when the summer solstice was, when the fall and summer equinoxes were. And so they knew what was going to be the shortest day of the year. And as the days were getting shorter and shorter and shorter throughout the winter, people were getting more and more worried about, is the sun going out? Is it going to get colder and colder and never warm up? And, of course, these are people who had oral traditions, oral histories. So there were actually stories of times when it did get cold and it didn't get warm again, because there had been periods of time like that. I mean, the old Ice Age. In fact, just another interesting anecdote. When I lived in Vermont, there was a study done, I believe it was by the University of Vermont. The Abenaki people in Vermont have these stories of when the glaciers receded and how and where and stuff like that. Somebody decided to do the science and check it out and discovered, sure enough, they've got a 10,000-year-old accurate memory. I mean, that's the power of oral tradition, oral histories. So anyhow, there's this concern among these people, you know, the sun might go out, it might get colder and colder and never warm up again. And so, you know, looking at his calendar stone, the priest would know, okay, this is going to be the shortest day of the year. And so on that shortest day of the year, which is, you know, more or less December 22nd, December 23rd, he would go up on top of the mountain and he'd find the biggest tree he could find and he would just set that sucker on fire and have this great big ceremony all around where everybody gets around the tree and lights the tree on fire and let's reignite the sun! Bring it back! And they'd all, they'd dance and whatever as they're standing around this flaming tree trying to reignite the sun. And then the next day, the morning would come a little earlier. And the evening would start a little later. And the next day after that, a little earlier in the morning and a little later in the day. And the sun is coming back and it's getting brighter and it's getting warmer. And all the people look at the priest and they go, he did it again. He did it again. I guess we'll keep him in charge for another year. Good work if you can get it, right? So that's my understanding from having been there of at least the oral tradition in Germany about where the Christmas tree came from. And then, of course, it got appropriated by Christians who basically took that holiday. I shouldn't speak of Christians in the third person. I myself am a Christian. We Christians took that pagan holiday and said, you know, this is kind of cool. Right around the middle of winter, dead of winter, when you really do need a holiday. You know, things are getting gray. You really do need a holiday. Let's light a tree on fire and have a celebration and drink a lot of glögg what was it, Louise? The wine, Rotwein? No, that's red wine. Anyhow, there's this marvelous wine stuff that they drink in the northern European countries. So that in any case, SeaTac Airport, the Christmas tree is coming back. I mean, the right wingers are so intent on not wanting us to talk about the real issues, like the fact that the Arctic is melting, the real war on Christmas. The real war on Santa Claus. Santa Claus is home. Ask any little kid. Where? The North Pole. He's got his little house there, and he's got his factory, and his elves live there. Well, how are they going to live there if there's no more snow, there's no more ice, if it's all open sea? Andrew Revkin, writing in the New York Times, new studies project that the Arctic Ocean could be mostly open water during the summer by 2040. Several decades earlier than previously expected, partly as a result of global warming caused by emissions of greenhouse gases. That's the real war on Christmas. Polar bears going extinct. Entire communities of Aboriginal and Indigenous people who live around the Arctic Circle, from the Russian side to the Alaskan side to the Northern Canadian side, being wiped out, no longer able to hunt, no longer able to trust the ice. Communities melting as the sinking into the mud as the permafrost goes. But the cons don't want you talking about that. They'd rather have you talk about the fact that the Port of Seattle took down the Christmas tree. Actually, trees, 14 of them. They didn't call them Christmas trees. They called them holiday trees, which is entirely appropriate in my mind because they predate Christmas. If anybody's going to claim these lit up trees, correctly and righteously, it should be the pagans, the Wiccans. They actually have a tradition that includes these things. You won't find anything in the Bible about Christmas trees. Not a word. Not Jewish, it's not Christian, it's not Muslim. Which is, of course, why the Jehovah's Witnesses and some of the Seventh-day Adventists and some of the Anabaptists and some of the very conservative Methodist sects will not use Christmas trees. But that's not enough for the right-wingers who want us to talk about anything except the real war on Christmas, which is the war on the Arctic, which is the war on the climate, which is the war on all life on Earth. Weekend before last, I was at I'm not quite sure what to call it. It was a conference, but it was by invitation only, so it was kind of a closed thing, the Praxis Peace Conference in San Francisco. And it was fascinating. George Lakoff showed up and spent a day with us. Stuart Pym was there. He's going to be with us on the program a little later on this week, is it?
Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, David says. He's going to be with us. The World According to Pym, professor of Duke University, pointed out that within 35 years, half of all species on Earth may be extinct if we don't do something quickly. Half of all species. Now, the Earth is a biological system. It is not a machine. This is part of the problem, is our thinking that it's just a machine. You know, I can take my car apart and spread the pieces all over the driveway, and if I have the technical knowledge, I don't, but I could get it, I could put it back together and it would run. That's a machine. But if I tried taking my cat apart and spreading him all over the driveway and then putting him back together. God forbid. Louise is cringing. He would not meow again. And that's how the world is. And when you have a complex biological system, yeah, we're fairly complex biological systems too, and we can run without one eye or without one ear or without one kidney, but half of all our organs? No, sorry. We croak. And that's, you know, if we don't do something about the real war on all life on Earth, frankly, rather than getting into these hysterical rants by the O'Reillys of the world about the war on Christmas, if we don't do something about the real war on life, we're going to be confronting some very, very serious times. And there's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot that is being done. Talk about that and take your calls after 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
The polar caps are melting at a rapid pace. And rising ocean levels soon could harm the human race. But they have got no proof, their theories are correct. Our corporations don't get enough respect. So come on.
Slash it!
Slash another little piece of the forest, baby.
Burn it!
Burn another little piece of Brazil, it feels so good. Forest down, baby. No need to worry, cause there's plenty more water.
Oh, yes, just cut that forest down. Just heat that atmosphere up. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. Some ice could still be found on coastlines, notably Greenland and Ellesmere Island, but the rest of the Arctic Ocean, including the poles, would be open water. This from Lewis Smith, the environment reporter for the Times of London. He's quoting the British Antarctic Survey that's talking about the Arctic Ocean. So, and they actually say it might be even sooner than that. He's quoting Professor Chris Rapley head of the British Antarctic Survey. He says, a recent study by the Global Carbon Project suggests emissions are rising more than twice as fast in 2000. Than as in 2000, which is likely to speed up ice loss even further. He said the study findings may be an underestimate of when the Arctic summer ice may be all gone. And this is because there's two things going on here. One is the actual global warming and more heat concentrating at the poles. Global warming means you see the extremes at the poles more than at the equator, actually, these changes in temperature. And the second is that as ice melts and turns to water, water absorbs heat from the sun, ice reflects heat from the sun, and so you get this positive feedback loop. A thermostat is a negative feedback loop. It's a desirable thing, a thermostat, this negative feedback loop where, you know, it turns on the heat, and when the heat reaches a certain threshold, it turns it off. That's a negative feedback loop. That's how, you know, a thermostat in your home works. A positive feedback loop, in the context of temperature anyway, would be temperature gets turned on, and it just keeps turning it on faster and faster and faster and more and more and more, and there's no stopping it. Not a good thing. But in any case, the phony war on Christmas, folks, can stop hyperventilating. Tonight, the Port of Seattle staff began putting up the trees they'd taken down last Friday night. And this is, a local rabbi did not ask that the trees be taken down, by the way. I know the right-wing meme is out there that there was a threat of a lawsuit, that he wanted the trees taken down. He never said that. In fact, Pat Davis, the Port of Seattle Commission president, said, the rabbi never asked us to remove the trees. It was the port's decision based on what we knew at the time. We very much appreciate the rabbi's willingness to work with us and move forward. And this is Rabbi Bogomilsky, who works with the Chabad Lubavitch, the Lubavitchers, an Orthodox Jewish outreach organization, who said, the rabbi said, like people from all cultures and religions, we're thrilled the trees are going back up. He said, at the end of the day, it's not about trees, but about adding light to the holiday, not diminishing any light. And really, I think that that's what it's always been about. So, anyway, it's fine to see that the war on the phony war on Christmas is not so much getting all the publicity. And to a large extent, people are starting to realize that the real killers of Santa are James Inhofe and his buddies over at the Republican Party and all the corporations hanging out with him. Speaking of James Inhofe and his buddies over at the Senate and the Republicans, it looks like Pat Roberts, who has been sitting on phase two of the Intelligence Committee report, which talks about how the Bush administration lied us into war, is not only being set aside. I mean, there's a lot of talk that Pat Roberts has Alzheimer's, that he's got some serious problems here. And Pat Roberts is no longer going to be chairman of the committee. Jay Rockefeller will be. And Jay Rockefeller says he plans to complete the three unreleased sections of the Phase 2 report and release them. And so, you know, some news is going to be coming out. And I would say that for a lot of the Republicans, particularly for the Bush administration, this is kind of like from bad to worse, you know, the fact that this is going to come out. And then Harry Reid. Entering the office of incoming Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid can be a bit of an intimidating experience. This is Bob Geiger writing over the DOE, Democratic Underground. Harry Reid, we're going to find out how the intelligence was manipulated taking us to war. That's what needs to be done. Finding out, you know, and Harry Reid's going to make it happen. I'm telling you, nobody wants to talk about impeachment right now. And appropriately so, you don't talk about it. You don't go on TV and say, yes, that guy should be put to death for what he before the trial is held. And you don't hold the trial before you do the investigation. We need to do the investigations, and I'll bet you just about anything, those investigations are going to lead to clear smoking gun evidence that this nation has been lied to, that high crimes and misdemeanors worthy not only of impeachment but probably prosecution have been committed, and we should go forward. Time now for the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for today: who's the real victim of the war on Christmas? Whose house is getting melted by the Republicans in the Senate? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It, 27 minutes past the hour.
When you think back to biblical times, when Adam and Eve talked to that snake 6,000 years ago, when the world was created, it was hot back then, too. Why do you think Adam and Eve were naked? See what I'm saying? I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. You know, you didn't hear Adam and Eve running around talking about emission standards or hybrid cars. In fact, Adam and Eve drove an excursion.
Cut! I'm the old Bible Belt Bailey who you bamboozled on. Forget your AWOL and your DUI. You gave them a show that always pleases. Your friends claimed you were endorsed by Jesus. You're razzle-dazzle-dum, razzle-dazzle-dum, razzle-dazzle-dum. And make sane people cry.
Razzle-dazzle-dum, 35 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. And we have a winner in our Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question, who is the next victim of the war on Christmas, or whose home is being melted by the real villains in the war on Christmas? And congratulations to Daryl Kikuchi of Marysville, Washington. Daryl got it right that Santa Claus, the North Pole, or arguably all of nature, the natural world. That's the real war that's being waged by the Reichwingers. And the origins of the Christmas tree. Pagan traditions. This is from religioustolerance.org. Many pagan cultures used to cut boughs of evergreen trees in December, move them into the home or temple to decorate them. Modern-day pagans still do. This is to recognize the winter solstice, the time of year that has the shortest daylight hours. They noticed that the days were getting gradually shorter. Many feared that the sun would eventually disappear forever and everyone freeze. But even though the deciduous trees, bushes, and crops died or hibernated for the winter, evergreen trees remain green. They seem to have magical powers. Not having evergreen trees, the ancient Egyptians considered the palm tree to symbolize resurrection. They decorated their homes with palm branches during the winter solstice. The first decorating of an evergreen tree began with the heathen Greeks in their worship of the god Adonia, who allegedly was brought back to life by the serpent Asclepius after having been slain. The ancient Romans decorated their trees with bits of metal and replicas of their god Bacchus, a fertility god. They also placed 12 candles on the tree in honor of the sun god. Their midwinter festival, Saturnalia, started on December 17th and lasted until a few days after December 23rd, like right around the 25th. This is the 10 days of Christmas, the 12 days of Christmas. How many days of Christmas are there? Okay. In Northern Europe, ancient Germanic people tied fruit and attached candles to evergreen tree branches in honor of the god Wotan, or Votan, as they would pronounce it there. Trees were symbolized as eternal life. Holly, mistletoe, all these things, the Yule log, all this predated Christianity. In Christianity, it appears that it started with St. Boniface, 675. Cut down a deciduous tree in the presence of some newly baptized Christians. It was an oak, once sacred to the former pagans, miraculously split into four pieces, revealing an evergreen tree, thus the beginning. And Martin Luther, good old Martin Luther, nailing his arguments to the church door, his protestations, was so impressed by a forest scene that he allegedly cut down a small fir tree, took it home, and decorated it with lighted candles. This is the earliest documented record of a Christmas tree in Germany. But it's dated to 60 years after his death, so nobody knows if it actually happened or not. So, anyhow, more than you ever wanted to know about Christmas trees or Yule trees or whatever. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number, Bob in Eugene, Oregon. Bob, you say the Bible, you want to disagree with me, the Bible does mention Christmas trees?
Yeah, that's right.
Where?
At Jeremiah 10.
Tell me, give me the quote.
Okay, look, I'm trying to get it on my computer now, but I'm not real good. I'm real Luddite here.
First of all, Jeremiah was long before Jesus, and so
that's okay. I'm not arguing with you. We're on the same page, buddy. But if you okay. If you're better with your computer than I am, punch up Jeremiah 10, and to paraphrase, it says, "Do not follow the way of nations, those who take a tree unto their house, affix it to the floor, and adorn it with gold."
Which is what the Romans did. In other words, he was arguing against.
Speaks specifically against Christmas trees.
And the other thing is, you know, there are two places in the New Testament where Jesus cursed a fig tree and it died. And there's one place in the Old Testament where, as I recall, it was Isaiah, it might have been Jeremiah, one of the old prophets, cursed a fig tree and it died. And so I am convinced that the people, that Fred Phelps and his buddies, you know, where their God hates fags,
yeah.
That they got it wrong. It's a typo. It's God
figs.
Hates figs. I'm serious. Three places, fags are not mentioned. That word does not exist in the Bible. But figs exist three times in the Bible, and each time God is cursing them. So it should be God hates figs. And there's probably a website out there, GodHatesFigs.com. But I'm getting it. Bob, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, my wife and I were jokingly saying we're going to start a Christmas tree lot and call it Jeremiah 10 Christmas Trees.
Oh yeah.
So look it up. Look it up if you got your thing there and read it. And
yeah.
it definitely speaks against Christmas trees in the Bible. So there you have it, my friend. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'll trust you on it, Bob. Thanks a lot for the call. Eva in San Francisco, listening on the Quake. Hey Eva, what's up?
Merry Christmas, Mr. Hartman.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, too, and happy holidays of all sorts.
Yes, this is Eva Hart, and I'm a Christian, and I want to call about Say Peace for the Poor Christmas and to discuss the healthcare history with you.
Yeah, now, if you really want to talk about the spirit of Christmas or the spirit of the holiday season, let's say, correctly, because all of the religions that celebrate around this holiday season, all of those celebrations have to do with peace on earth, goodwill toward men, you know, as it
exactly.
were, and women.
May I say my piece now?
Please.
Sure. It's this, that our three forms of government, I only ask that to understand if I can say it. Our three forms of city government came about because as cities grew, people demanded health care, fire, police protection, libraries, and playgrounds. So it is democracy to give health care. And my piece for the poor would be at Christmas for peace and to all is that in Matthew 13, Jesus warns of the parable of the weeds and the wheats, of the good and bad living together, not excommunicated. Jesus warns his disciples not to anticipate God's final judgment by an exclusion of sinners from the kingdom. In its present stage, it consists of the good and the bad. And finally, so we must live, he wants his disciples to preach patience and repentance.
Right, and finally, Eva?
And finally, so we must try to live the time limit off these welfare programs. because the poor, the adulterer, the gay people are all included in Jesus' love, not to mention low wages and dirty hard jobs that lead to nowhere.
Indeed. Indeed. The bottom line, Eva, is that Jesus was the original liberal, and there's a bumper sticker to that effect, and more people need to get it. 1-866-440-T, and thank you, Eva, for the call. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Chris in Fremont, California. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hey, first time I've listened to you. I'm from the East Coast. I'm a conservative warmonger, SUV driver. Hope you humor me for a minute.
Okay, well, that's fine. I'm curious, why are you a warmonger, Chris?
There's people out there that want to kill us. They want the caliphate. They want to rule the Islamic fascists, want to rule the world. It's not about oil. It's not about anything.
And, Chris, do you think that they would want to kill us if we weren't there?
Pardon?
Do you think?
Oh, most definitely.
Why?
Most definitely.
Why would they want to kill us if we were not there?
We could debate that for hours.
No. How about just a one sentence answer? Why would they want to kill us if we're not there? I mean, you've got, you know, for example, Mugabe.
Wait, let me answer your question.
Okay, go ahead.
They believe it is their destiny to rule the world. It's about power.
Actually, if you listen to them, what you would get is that they believe that it's their destiny to rule their part of the world. Most of their creation myths have to do with the Middle East, not with us.
Well, I beg to differ on that.
Well, my book for the month, 2 months ago at BuzzFlash.com, was The Collected Writings of Osama Bin Laden. It's like, know your enemy, right?
I
actually read them, and I can tell you, Osama Bin Laden, back in 1998, when he published in the New York Times his declaration of war against the United States, he said that there were two reasons why he was coming after us, and he was going to come after us. Number one was Bush Sr. had put American troops on Saudi soil, and thus defiled Saudi soil because women were driving and their elbows were showing and men were watching pornography and drinking alcohol. And he wanted our troops removed. And number two, we were pumping oil from Saudi Arabia at a price below what he thought was appropriate. He thought it should be at least $80 to $100 a barrel, and we were therefore stealing the wealth of the Holy Land of his country. And until those two things were solved, he was going to continue to attack America. And sure enough, last year, George W. Bush pulled all of our troops out of Saudi Arabia, and the price of oil went up to $80 a barrel. Osama bin Laden is still loose. It looks to me like George Bush has given Osama bin Laden everything he wants, and you think that that's good?
Then why are they still attacking us then?
When was the last time they attacked us? I don't recall them having attacked us since 9/11 here in the United States.
Well, like I said, we can, you know, I'm a combat vet. I've done a tour in Afghanistan. I've done a tour in Iraq. And what's defeated us has been the negative perception.
The surrender monkeys. Chris, we have 30 seconds.
That's a different, okay. Are you aware of the Newsweek article that Dennis Miller dug up?
No.
Okay, it's a 1975 article in Newsweek. It's April of, I'm not sure the exact year, all the same experts. It's almost word for word for a similar article on global warming, but just substitute the word cooling. And all your so-called experts that are claiming this global warming now, were claiming
So Chris, you're going to say that 2,300 of the world's top climate scientists and hundreds of millions of dollars of research should be ignored because Dennis Miller was able to dig up a crackpot article from Newsweek in 1975. Chris, you're a great and sterling example of the conservative mindset, and I appreciate you calling in. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election, you know, we'd really settle for that.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
I must have dreamed a thousand dreams. Been haunted by a million screams. I can hear the marching feet. They're moving into the street. Now, did you read the news today?
And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 9 minutes before the hour. By the way, special welcome to Phoenix, our Phoenix affiliate, 1480 KPHX, Los Angeles, KTLK, 1150, AM 1150, in Burlington, Vermont, Plattsburgh, New York, WTWK, all three stations picking us up live on Monday of this week. And to all of our affiliates, to all of our stations who are carrying this program live, we're live noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 a.m. to noon Pacific Time. Thanks so much. Not one of our radio stations, and not one of the stations that carries this program live, has moved it. There has been some motion going on, shall we say, in the progressive talk radio world, and we have not lost a single affiliate, and in fact just picked up three more this week. So, good news. And that's it for my inside radio conversation. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet, go to TomHartman.com. It's T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, but however you spell it, we'll get you there. And just click live chat right up at the top of the page. It'll drop you in there. Scott in Richmond, Virginia on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Thank you, Tom. I have a message of hope for the holiday season.
What's that?
We have some family friends and our sons are friends that are hardcore evangelicals. They go on missions several times a year, mm-hmm. voted straight Republican based on like two or three issues. And recently, because of problems that they've had, the church had turned their back on them, mm-hmm. and they kind of had an awakening that the issues that they were voting on or the things that they were being told were totally anti-Christian, against the teachings of Jesus. And as a matter of fact, I would talk to their son when he was over saying, I don't understand how you guys can be voting Republican when you consider that all the liberal causes are things that Jesus was for.
Yeah, well, exactly.
The husband of the family just went on a tirade the other day that lasted about 15 minutes about, you know, everything I thought I believed, I don't believe anymore.
Politically speaking, you mean?
Well, politically and religiously, but he said, as far as I'm concerned, abortion is between that person and their God, the same thing with homosexuality. All the things that we might have mentioned to them that they were vehemently against, he's truly been reborn in the faith.
That's
cool. So there's hope out there.
You're right, Scott. There's a lot of hope out there. Thank you for that. An interesting message. Thanks, you too. Have a great holiday season. 1-866-440-THOM. Norma in Long Beach, California. Hey, Norma. Welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. Thank you. I'm glad to hear your interesting. Oh, gosh, you've been fabulous this morning.
Thank you.
I have one question, and I would like to see if anybody knows the answer. I've always heard and read Peace on Earth, Goodwill Toward Men. You mentioned it this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we grew up learning Peace on Earth toward men of goodwill.
I believe it's a quote from Isaiah, but I'm not, it's been enough years since I read the Bible with any regularity that I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know it, Norma.
Well, it's just something, if anybody finds out, I'd just like to have it.
I think that you're...
It makes a little bit of a difference.
Yeah, toward men of goodwill is correct. I believe that that's right, but I can't say that I know for sure. But thank you for the call. Great to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. John in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I love your show, and it's very, very educational. Thank you.
Thank you. What's up?
Hey, Tom, quick question for you. I was wondering, why is violence so acceptable on TV and sex is not? I've never seen anyone die from a pair of women's breasts.
You know, it's something that I've pointed out many times in this program and always thought was very weird, is that, you know, we protect our children from sexuality, which is something that all of us, most of us anyway, the vast majority of us grow up to participate in, and we don't protect our children from violence like murder, which is something that we explicitly ask people not to grow up to do. And it does seem bizarre, and I suspect that it may have something to do with why in the United States we have one of the highest murder rates in the world and certainly the highest incarceration rate in the world, whereas in other countries where the media isn't so full of violence and they're a little more charitable with sexuality, you don't have that. When we lived in Germany, for example, I remember one time the Der Spiegel, the German equivalent of Newsweek, you know, the big national weekly newspaper, walking by a newsstand, Louise and our kids were all fairly young at the time, and here's a man and a woman, full total frontal nudity, on the cover of, you know, holding hands on the cover of the magazine. And it was about a story about evolution, as I recall, or something like that. But
right.
instead of Adam and Eve having fig leaves, I mean, they were totally naked. And this was on every news, and this was news, you know, the German equivalent of Newsweek. They were never, I think it all goes back to Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria was just wildly and weirdly neurotic about sex. The Victorian era in England became crazed about sex, and it infected the United States. It didn't infect the rest of Europe. And so the rest of Europe, in Scandinavian countries, for example, they looked down very, very strongly on violence in being depicted in their media, and don't care all that much about sex. So I think that there's something to be said for a healthy reevaluation of these things. I think, John, you nailed it right on the head there. Thanks for listening to us on KPHX there in Phoenix. 56 minutes past the hour. Right after the news, the top of the hour, Charles Derber is going to be with us. My book of the month at BuzzFlash last month, Hidden Power. And some fascinating thoughts about what's coming around for the Democrats, the Republicans, the cycles of American history. You've heard me talk about it before. This is the guy who's the source of much of the thinking on that. Should be fascinating. We'll be getting back with your calls and more news of the day. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change in America. Yeah, it's a double entendre. Welcome back. Charles Derber is with us. CharlesDerber.com is website. He is the author of what I think is one of the best books on politics out there right now, a book that you really need to buy and read. It's called Hidden Power, What You Need to Know to Save Our Democracy. Charles Derber, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. I made your book the BuzzFlash Book of the Month last month. I just thought it was so well done and so important. You talk about in your book the various regimes that have ruled America, and I thought your use of the word regime was very revealing. First of all, tell us, you know, who really controls America?
Well, it's not going to be news to your audience. It's largely what I call the third corporate regime. There have been two prior corporate regimes since the Civil War. One was the robber barons during the 1890s. The second was during the business regimes of the 20s under Harding and Coolidge and Coolidge.
1921 to 1933.
Yes. And what I mean by a regime, Tom, is just that I think people are so drawn into the horse race of elections and the political partisan kinds of things that go on, and we're constantly being drawn in already to the presidential, that people lose sight of the fact that most times when even when parties shift, there is not a real change in power in real political discourse. Instead, you get sort of changes in the hats that without any real change in policy, and it reflects the fact that the country is not really run, in my judgment, by the people that we elect, who are, because they're largely in service to sponsors, often financially very munificent sponsors, who largely direct both domestic and foreign policy. And so I think a classic case of this was when Clinton was elected in the 90s. You had the current regime, which I call the third corporate regime, elected with Reagan. When Clinton came in, he more or less acknowledged that he had, the things that he aspired toward had become the common sense of that regime: smaller government, the end of welfare as we know it, streamlining various social spending programs and so forth. He basically swam as fast as he could away from kind of the New Deal.
From which
was the regime, the one regime in the 20th century that had advanced a relatively progressive, although not truly populist kind of agenda.
Right. So let me just set this up for our listeners, because I think that they might have gotten lost. Some folks might have gotten lost in this.
Sure.
What you're positing is that there is a flipping back and forth throughout American history between what are essentially populist or pro-person or progressive, by and large, regimes, that regardless of whether it's the Democratic or the Republican Party. And you start in 1865. I would submit to you, and I'd love to hear your take on this, that really we had a populist regime from the early late 1760s through probably the early 1830s or the late 1820s. Then it became a corporatist regime until the late 1850s. And then with the rise of the Republican Party as a progressive party, and Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, it became a populist regime. And then by the mid-1860s or so, it became again a corporate regime. But in your book, you define 1865 to 1901, this was the Gilded Age, this was the first corporate regime. Then in 1901, with Teddy Roosevelt, we began the progressive regime, 1901 to 21, the progressive era, busting up the trusts and advancing the people. Then from 21 to 33, the second corporate regime, the corporations took over again, and the Roaring Twenties, Harding, Hoover. And then with the Republican Great Depression, 1933, we got into the New Deal regime, and that lasted all the way up until 1980, from 1933 to 1980. Where basically you said Franklin Roosevelt designs it as the people's house. And then from 1980 to today, we've been basically operating under the third corporate regime. This is the third time corporations have ruled America. The first time, 1865 to 1901. The second time from 1921 to 1933.
Right.
And now the third time, 1980 to 2006, this third corporate regime. First of all, am I stating that well?
Perfectly, Tom. I might quibble with you about some of the pre-Civil War regimes. I think there's a lot of romanticizing of the very, I mean, after all, there was a slaveocracy in the early periods and so forth.
You're
but
right.
but
You're
that's right. not important to debate right now. But
yeah.
your summary of the post-Civil War, and I think what's important about that is that real change in America, I'm trying to argue, doesn't happen in tandem with electoral cycles, and it doesn't happen all that often. You get parties changing back and forth, and no real major change happens. But sometimes certain crises emerge, which do catapult sort of the grassroots into action and lead to a fundamental change in both institutional power and in the political conversation, the basic assumptions.
Yeah. Now, my sense of this, we're talking about Charles Derber, he's the author of Hidden Power, What You Need to Know to Save Our Democracy. My sense of this, Charles, is that we are at a point, right? And by the way, I should add, you're a professor of sociology at Boston College,
right. Mm-hmm.
And author of 9 previous books, People
sure.
Before Profit, Corporate Nation, the Wilding of America, and others. That my sense of it is that we are on the verge of either continuing this third corporate regime that started with the Reagan Revolution in 1980, or moving into a more populist direction. And for example, in the Democratic Party, you have John Edwards representing the populist wing, and I would argue probably Howard Dean as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, at least at the moment, Hillary Clinton representing the corporate regime, and obviously Rahm Emanuel and some of these others. And really the point that I think you make so elegantly in the book is that it's not even really the politician, it's the forces of the day. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt
exactly.
was elected as a rich, white, instrument of Republican power, and he became a raging populist because the people rose up and pushed him in that direction. So even if Hillary Clinton were elected president and she was elected as a corporatist, she could become a populist.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton is definitely the center of the corporate regime. I mean, she in herself is not going to be a regime changer. But there will be a shift. I mean, first of all, as you know, because you've written about it yourself, I think we're in a pivotal moment where, because of the war on terrorism and the way it's been framed and so forth and the disaster that's unfolding around the world, you could have a rightward shift from the third corporate regime toward a proto-fascist, I call it fascist light. And
right.
one of the wonderful things, I mean, that's a very important subject we don't have time to address right now, but you've written about it very eloquently. And
there's a great chapter about it in your book as well.
Thank you, yes. And I think that the one really, even though the midterms was not a regime change, and if Hillary is elected, it will not be a regime change. One, it's put a little bit of a finger in the dike around the very strong pressures toward a right-wing regime change that could have happened if Congress had stayed with the Republicans and given Bush another mandate. Because Bush is right on the cusp of a kind of shift away from the corporate regime, although he very much embodies it, toward this, what I call fascism light. Now, I agree completely with your take on the idea that when a centrist Democrat or even a liberal Democrat is elected, you simply put into place the possibilities of a progressive regime change. And one of the things, you know, the last third of my book, which I think people appreciate, is that there's a hopeful message here, too, which is that you do get these periodic shifts away from financial power and corporate power, which most people sort of, you know, shake their heads and say, no, it ain't going to happen. It just happened. But we, you know, the best prediction of the future is the past. And the United States is entering a period of hegemonic decline, which is going to shake the country. I mean, as things unfold and fall apart in the Middle East, and as the trade deficits and the fiscal problems and the social inequalities and all the obvious glaring contradictions of this regime.
All of which, ironically, Reagan put into place.
Yes. So you can see them very right at the
beginning.
I
mean, he created the seeds of the destruction of his own philosophy.
Exactly. Yes, right, from the very beginning.
So as this stuff begins to crash, we only have a minute left here, Charles Durber. As this stuff begins to crash, the bottom line that you're suggesting is that the United States could either move toward a more fascistic direction, kind of a Sinclair Lewis, it can't happen here, Coonskin cap fascism, or we could move back into the New Deal, into a progressive era, and become more like the northern European countries. And it's going to be up to we the people to do it.
You've got the story. I couldn't say it better.
And so the work that we all have to do, and you summarize this so well in your book, Hidden Power, What You Need to Know to Save Our Democracy, the work that we all need to do is to wake people up to the fact that we are standing at this turning point here in the United States. We can go one way or the other, and it is not up to the economic elite, it is not up to the political elite,
right.
It is up to each one of us.
I think that's the key message. I mean, I'm talking to Howard Dean about half an hour. Dean has read my stuff, and, you know, I think that he would like to see this, but the real change is going to come from the grassroots. There's absolutely no doubt about it. If you're looking for the elite in either party to do this, you're going to be looking your whole life. It's going
Indeed.
To historically.
Well, this is the way all change.
The
yeah, all change has always happened, whether it was the abolition movement or the
exactly.
suffrage movement or anything.
Yeah.
It always happens from the ground up. Charles Durber, the book Hidden Power, What You Need to Know to Save Our Democracy, charlesdurber.com, the website. Thanks for being with us today, Charles.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Lonely feeling. Find the corner where I can hide. Silent footsteps crowding me. Sudden darkness, but I can see.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Charles Durber talking about, in the last segment, talking about these regimes, the corporate regimes and the progressive regimes, and how we flip back and forth throughout the years. And this is the history of America, of the United States of America, is flipping back and forth between periods of time, blocks of time, regardless of which party is in power, because one of the most progressive of our presidents was a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, another progressive president, Abraham Lincoln. He was the first president to actually stop police from breaking up strikes. The word strike was so novel in the 1850s, 1860s, that it was in quotes in newspapers. And Abraham Lincoln saying, no, sorry, labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital. In other words, you don't have money until somebody makes something. So you had a couple of progressive Republicans back in the day. You could argue that there were some substantial progressive portions to Dwight Eisenhower's rule. Dwight Eisenhower was president, Republican president, during the New Deal regime from 1933 until 1980. And he was in favor of a 90% top marginal tax rate. He was in favor of Social Security. He was in large part, you know, in that context, you could say, in some ways, he was a progressive. And he talked about peace. I mean, his whole campaign was about peace. Vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace, his 1952 campaign. So it's not so much about the politicians, it's about the regime. And so the question then becomes, how do we keep America from flipping into from this corporatist regime that we've had since 1980, brought to you courtesy of Ronald Reagan and the October surprise, the theft of the October of the 1980 election, cutting the deal with the Iranians and all that to hold the hostages and wiping out Carter. How do we flip? How do we prevent this corporate regime from flipping into a proto-fascist regime on the one hand and push it into a more progressive regime back into the New Deal? Now, oddly, this is something very similar to what Franklin Roosevelt inherited when he came into the White House. Franklin Roosevelt, again, was not elected as a radical reformer. In the election of 1932, you had Hoover, whose campaign slogan was "Prosperity is just around the corner," as the United States was sliding deeper and deeper into the Great Depression, the Republican Great Depression. And people were referring to it as such. And then you had Franklin Roosevelt, who was saying, well, I'm not an ideologue. I'm a pragmatist. Let's, we'll try some things. We'll try this, that, and the other thing. But, we need to do something other than just wait and leave it to the robber barons, which was Hoover's strategy. Just leave it to the corporations. Let's just privatize everything. Now, the way that we can flip into a progressive regime, because the change is going to happen. I guarantee you, the change is going to happen. This current corporatist regime that started in 1980 is imploding. It's falling apart. Whether it is the immigration policies that Reagan put into place to try to destroy labor, whether it is the lack of immigration policies, whether it is the war against organized labor that Reagan put into place, declaring war against the middle class, the American middle class and organized labor in 1981 when he busted up PATCO, starting with that and transforming the nature of the National Labor Relations Board, taking us from 25% of the American workforce unionized in 1981 when Reagan came into power to about 8% now, the private workforce. Whether it's that, or whether it's the disastrous international trade policies that Reagan pushed for, that Bush Sr. got some of, and that Clinton kicked the door wide open to, that have led to the destruction, massive swaths of the American workplace, the destruction of American jobs, and the insane policies associated with that that have been pursued by folks like Thomas Friedman and the Republicans and Democrats who are pursuing that corporatist agenda. It is imploding. It is becoming increasingly obvious to Americans it's not working. That the trade policies are not working, that we can't have an $800 billion a year trade deficit and have the rest of the world coming in and buying up our companies and our natural resources and end up with nothing left. That's not going to fly. It's getting really bad. And we can't have an $8 trillion debt. So all of this stuff, it's becoming obvious it's not going to work. Which way are we going to work? When Roosevelt came into office in 1933, he had on the right the fascists, I mean literally the fascists, the people who were looking at Benito Mussolini and saying, that guy's got some pretty good ideas. Folks like Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh saying, why don't we go in that direction and bring the corporations in? Mussolini had dissolved parliament and replaced each territory, instead of sending an elected representative, the largest corporation in that area sent a representative to parliament, the Cameo de Fascio Corporaciones. So you had people on the right saying, well, why don't we do that? And you had the people on the left, like, my grandfather, the socialist, saying, well, why don't we try doing what the Bolsheviks were talking about? And both of those, Roosevelt looked at both of those. He said, we're not going to go communist and we're not going to go fascist. And thank God, by the way. And he said, we're going to go down the middle. We're going to preserve American democracy and we're going to preserve free enterprise. And we're actually even going to try to save capitalism from itself, because laissez-faire capitalism was destroyed itself. How do we do that? The New Deal. And it lasted until 1980, and we need to bring some semblance of that back. How do we do it? Right after this, 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our radio stations, our affiliate stations, the local sponsors advertising on them. Please pay attention to those ads. And contact those local sponsors. Let them know you're listening and buy products from them. That's how you support Progressive Talk Radio, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX and SmallDog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ECOWINE.com. Welcome back to our program. We were talking about, is America going to flip in the direction, I mean, we're at the crossroads that America was at in 1933 in some ways. I would argue we're not quite there, but the small bomb that went off in October of 1929, the stock market crash, could have an analog in a small bomb going off, for example, in an American city if there was to be a terrorist incident. Another anthrax attack. The anthrax attack, you'll recall, just as the Senate, which had fallen into the hands of the Democrats as a result of the Republican from Vermont saying, you know, no more. I'm going to become an independent. And so the Senate falls into the hands of the Democrats, and there's only two men on the Democratic Party, two men in the Senate, two Democrats in the Senate, who had the power to stop the Patriot Act as the administration is trying to push that through. That was Tom Daschle, the head of the Senate, and the Pat Leahy, the senator from Vermont. Jim Jeffords, the other senator, had the Republican to become an independent from Vermont. But Pat Leahy was the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He had to pass the Patriot Act out of committee, and Tom Daschle had to bring it to the floor for a vote. And these two guys could have stopped the Patriot Act. And all of a sudden, this anthrax shows up, and who are the only two guys in the Senate who get it? The two guys who are dissing the Patriot Act and who had the power to stop it. And who sent the anthrax? Nobody knows. So anyhow, my point is that an event not unlike the crash of 1929, whether it's an economic crash, whether it's China stopping to buy our bonds, saying no more, we're not going to buy any more treasury bills or treasury bonds, or Iran puts together a euro-based oil bourse and suddenly the world starts trading oil in riyads or in euros or some other currency than the dollar. There are a number of things that could be the economic equivalent of what happened in 1929. Or there could even be something that a civil war type event. Only it wouldn't be like the Civil War, but I mean a military shock inside the United States, another anthrax attack, a bomb going off in a city, something like this, that could flip that could cause the United States to get so much closer than we are right now. Right now we're close enough that if you think about it, you can kind of sense that it's nearby, you can kind of see it on the horizon, you can hear the rumblings of it. We're not quite there, but we're awful close. Of either becoming, this nation either becoming once again a progressive nation like it was between 1933 and 1980, or flipping into becoming a fascism light like it was during the last 2 years of the John Adams administration in 1798 when he passed the Alien and Sedition Act and immediately started putting newspaper editors in prison for speaking out against him. I would say that was the only two-year period when we really had a fascistic government in the United States, John Adams, which is why he's thought so poorly of in history. So what's going to cause it? Well, on the right, the guys who want to flip us into a fascistic state are using the war on terror to do it. This is what they're promoting. And Britain has said, no, we're not going to go down that road. From the Observer this weekend, their newspaper, the British Foreign Office has asked ministers to ditch the phrase invented by Bush, war on terror, to avoid stirring up tensions within the Islamic world. Cabinet members have been told by the Foreign Office to drop the phrase war on terror and other terms seen as liable to anger British Muslims and increase tensions more broadly in the Islamic world. The shift marks a turning point in British political thinking about the strategy against extremism and underlines the growing gulf between the British and American approaches on this issue. So good on you, England, or the United Kingdom. Now, here in the United States, on the other hand, we've got some folks who are really digging in their heels, and Dick Cheney, frankly, is the one that scares me the most. If you go back to 1972, on June 1st, 1972, just, you know, put yourself in the Wayback Machine. Nixon was president. He was considered at that time, he was not yet considered a crook, right, shall we say. And he had just come back from the Soviet Union with Henry Kissinger. and this process that they call detente. And on June 1st, 1972, Nixon gave a speech in which he said, and I'm quoting now, this is Nixon's speech, June 1st, 72. Last Friday in Moscow, we witnessed the beginning of the end of that era which began in 1945. With this step, we have enhanced the security of both nations. We have begun to reduce the level of fear. By reducing the causes of fear for our two peoples and for all peoples of the world. End quote. That was Richard Nixon. Well, you know, this was making the Reich go nuts. I mean, the proto-fascists, the right-wingers within the administration and all that, they were going, what are you talking about? We can't have fear anymore. We've got to get back to duck and cover. We've got to have an enemy. So Nixon leaves in a scandal a year later, year and a half later. Jerry Ford comes in, and his Secretary of Defense and his Chief of Staff say, you know, without fear, how can we manipulate people? How can we extract billions of dollars of taxpayer money and give it to our buddies in the defense industry? We've got to have fear back. So Jerry Ford's Secretary of Defense, a man by the name of Don Rumsfeld, and Jerry Ford's Chief of Staff, a man by the name of Dick Cheney, created a program, first secretly and then openly, to undermine Nixon's peace treaty with the Soviet Union from June of 1972 and rebuild instead a state of fear. How did they do this? They claimed that the Soviets had a new secret weapon. It was a, to quote Don Rumsfeld, a weapon of mass destruction. To quote Dick Cheney, the chief of staff to Jerry Ford, that the President Ford didn't know about. That the CIA didn't know about, that nobody knew about but them. They said it was a nuclear submarine technology that was undetectable by current American technology. And they said because of this and similar technologies that they said the Soviets had, we had to redirect billions of dollars away from those awful domestic programs. So we've got to undo the New Deal. After all, as Rush Limbaugh is fond of reminding us,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
See, this was the first attempt to stop the New Deal regime, which lasted from 1933 until 1980. This is, we're looking now, 1974. Cheney and Rumsfeld arguing that the Soviets have this secret technology. The CIA says, no way, they don't have this technology. Dr. Ann Kahn, Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, she says, they couldn't say that the Soviets had acoustic means of picking up American submarines because they couldn't find it. So they said, well, maybe they have non-acoustic means. But there was no evidence that they had non-acoustic systems. So they're saying, and this is Ann Kahn, right? She's the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. She's quoting Rumsfeld. We can't find evidence that they're doing it the way everyone thinks they're doing it, so they must be doing it a different way. We don't know what that way is, but they must be doing it, even though there's no evidence. You get it? Rumsfeld and Cheney were saying that the fact that the CIA could not find these secret weapons of mass destruction that they said the Soviet Union had was proof that they existed and that they were so top secret that even the CIA couldn't find them. When Americans weren't buying this, they came up, they created a group inside the White House. It was called Team B. They put their old friend, this was a commission that they got Jerry Ford to appoint. Jerry Ford, you know, a well-meaning guy, he was just not the brightest bulb on the tree. He puts together this commission, and he puts Paul Wolfowitz in charge of it. Rumsfeld and Cheney's old friend. And then they reorganize the group a little later on as the Committee for on the Present Danger, which still exists to this day, by the way, to promote this worldview. They started getting on talk shows all over the country. The Soviets have this secret weapon of mass destruction. We can't detect it. That's proof that it's how dangerous it is. We've got to give trillions of dollars to the defense industry. More and more money. They were wrong, of course. But it cost us hundreds of billions of dollars. Vastly enriched the cronies of these guys. Ultimately helped bring Ronald Reagan to power because they recycled that money back into political campaigns. I mean, this is the tragedy of it. Franklin Roosevelt back in 1932. He says, this is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. This nation will endure as it has endured, will revive, and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified fear that paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. Franklin Roosevelt. Well, no. Cheney and Rumsfeld. They said, the only tool we have to manipulate the American people is fear itself. So what's it going to be, America? What are we going to do as we go into these next elections two years from now, and as we build a national consensus? Is it going to be flipping closer and closer to fear and fascism, or is it going to be rejecting fear and going back toward a progressive ideal of America as an egalitarian state? 45 minutes past the hour.
Smoggy skies and fixed elections, injustice strikes from all directions, people with their backs against the floor, looking for someone to set us free. The king with fists like Muhammad Ali. The holidays are here and we're still at war.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. FDR, yeah, he really said it.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And then on the other side...
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Indeed. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk a little bit about what I consider the greatest American hero of the recent history, of at least the 20th century, and that's General Smedley Butler.
Yes, indeed, who wrote War as a Racket and exposed the fact that Morgan and a group of big-time financiers had come to him and asked him to participate in a coup d'etat against Roosevelt.
Exactly, and it just amazes me that we've never been told about that coup. It's been a
It's not a secret. There's been a couple of books written on it. It's just that it's not taught in our history classes, which is a tragedy.
Certainly
but,
not.
But see, Roosevelt was actually complicit in that. He kept it covered up until he died because he was afraid that if the word got out that there had been an almost successful coup attempt against him, that it might encourage a successful one.
Now, he was brilliant on that, and he handed it over, and we ended up with a committee in Congress that exposed it, but then sealed the records until 1967.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that committee turned into the House on Committee on Un-American Affairs.
Un-American Activities, yeah. HUAC, yeah.
But that story needs to be told because that shows how very, very close we came to fascism.
Well, and that was the thing. I mean, at that point in time, and this was before the horrors of the Nazis were known, at that point in time, there were reasonable people in America on the two extremes. I mean, there actually was a far left in America. You know, I mentioned my grandfather. This is the eternal debate I used to hear as a kid between my grandfather, the socialist, and my father, the Republican. You had communists and socialists who were part of mainstream discourse in America in the 1920s and early 1930s. And you had people who were looking at what Mussolini did, the fascists, and thinking, well, maybe that's a reasonable way to go, because it sure doesn't seem that capitalism and American democracy as it's being played out is exactly the best thing to do. I mean, mostly these were arguments over economic systems, not political systems. And so it wasn't so much about democracy. But Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself. He kept us from going down either of those two roads. And I'm very concerned that we're, again, very close to that turning point. And all it's going to take is one major stock market crash, one currency crisis, or one bomb in an American city, and we will be at that turning point, and the decision is going to be made probably by whoever's in the White House or whoever controls Congress.
Could very well be. We're very close to that now with the dollar itself. But one more thing on Smedley Butler, like I say, unsung American hero.
Yep.
I mean, this story I really was distraught when I first learned about it, which was only in the last 2 years, that it hadn't been taught to me, because the American public would have been aware and on the lookout for something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can Google Smedley Butler. You can find his book, War is a Racket, online. It's also still in print. And, you know, he starts out the book by talking about how he was, I used to actually have the opening paragraph memorized. It's been 15 or 20 years now, about how he was the soldier for the industrialists, and, you know, he knocked over the Philippines for them, and he knocked over Guatemala for them, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He's a brilliant guy. Dave, I got to run along. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Jeff in San Francisco, listening on The Quake. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, well, I was listening to your chatting about Team B and Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz et al., and I just wanted to share. I asked your screener if you had discussed the Power of Nightmares documentary before on the program.
Yes,
I assumed you had.
I have on many occasions, yeah. And Adam Curtis is probably one of the most eloquent spokespeople on this topic. You can find he did a three-hour documentary. It's three one-hour segments called The Power of Nightmares. It ran on BBC4 a year ago, October, and created such a firestorm in England that Tony Blair had to come out and basically calm people down. They played it again in January. The same thing happened. Blair had to back away from Bush. It basically exposes how the Straussians, first of all, it exposes how the origin of the neocon movement, Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago in the 1950s and 60s, and the origins of Al-Qaeda, which came from a guy named Qutb, who started the Muslim Brotherhood, who was living in Colorado as an exchange student in the 1950s. And then he went back to Egypt and he tried to assassinate Nasser and so on. He was put to death for that. That became, you know, his student was Zawahiri, I can't keep them straight, the guy who is the mentor to Osama bin Laden. They describe him as his number two guy, but he's actually, you know, bin Laden is his number two guy. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood morphed into Al-Qaeda, and the neocon movement morphed into the Bush administration. And they both were looking at American society, you know, women's liberation and the birth control pill and kids smoking pot and saying no to the war and all that kind of, as the destruction of modern society. And they thought that in order to save society from itself, they had to bring back fear and very, very powerful and authoritarian organized religion.
Yep, and I thought, and boy, that's a great recap of that. I recommend it to everybody. And just from my own personal experience, I mean, I find it ironic, I shared this with your screener, that, you know, prior to watching The Power of Nightmares, I must confess, I had a little bit of lingering sort of faith in the, you know, good intentions of the neocon military politicians, military policy. That beat it out of me, and that's the irony about it, because...
Yeah, it really is. Jeff, but I've got to say, I think that they think that they're doing the right thing. They really believe that they're saving America. They're just wrong. I mean, you know, tragically wrong. By the way, Power of Nightmares, you can find it, I'm pretty sure, over Google Videos or Yahoo Videos. It's up on the web. It's not that hard to find. And I wrote a piece about it for Common Dreams about 2.5 years ago, which you can find over at tomhartman.com. Click Articles on Democracy and scroll down. Something about terror all wrapped up for the holidays. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll continue this and other news right after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, so sad yesterday afternoon to watch Mike Barnicle sucking up to Tom DeLay. It was downright tragic. Oh, man, but there he was. There he was. A lot going on today. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, the beginning of the third hour of our program. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way, has just warned about the dangers of globalization. We have the ongoing war against Christmas, which is actually the war against Santa Claus, which is the corporate effort to warm the planet to the point where there won't be a North Pole anymore. It'll be a North Ocean. We have the terrorists running around telling us that we have to be very afraid, as they have been doing since 1974 when Cheney, Wolfowitz, and Rumsfeld put together Plan B in the Committee on the Present Danger. Be afraid, be very afraid. And in the midst of all this, now comes Tom DeLay. He's discovered the blogosphere, and we'll, you know, get back to all of these topics, as it were, and the other events of the day. And, of course, there's, you know, everybody is handicapping and horse racing the presidential race of 2008. I think we'll pause on that one for a while. It's just, that's the low-hanging fruit. But Tom DeLay, here's Tom DeLay. This is incredible.
TomDeLay.com, right? Is that the blog?
That's the new DeLay, yes. That's my blog that we came out with today. And we're very pleased with it, being a lot of comments and a lot of hits on it.
So, like, do you get up first thing in the morning and start blogging away? Or how, what do you do?
Well, I'm not a very good writer. I have the ideas, and I have somebody else put the words together. But we're fine.
I have somebody else put. So it's his blog, but he doesn't actually run the blog. And the first 111 comments at TomDeLay.com were taken down. Yep. This is from CrooksandLiars.com. And TomDeLay.com.blogspot.com, you can find the whole thing. A tribute to the 75-minute period where Tom DeLay actually received feedback. The experiment has now ended, but let's see. The first person who blogged, logged out of Tom DeLay's blog, he says, your three first principles, order, justice, and freedom, obviously don't include honesty, integrity, or ethics. I particularly like the way the House Ethics Committee Chairman Joel Helfley was removed after rebuking you three times. Yes, he was replaced by DeLay groupie Doc Hastings with a couple of other groupies connected with your PAC. Sir, make sure no more untoward rebukes occur. It's a good thing you're no longer representative. The stench of the 109th Congress will take a long time to fix. That was the first comment. Here's the second comment. You are a bleeping disgrace to the ideas of Goldwater. Crawl back into a hole, you bleep. The fourth person who posted on Tom DeLay's blog said, Zalmay Khalilzad is now resigning as ambassador to Iraq. In my opinion, a staunch supporter of the war such as yourself should volunteer to fill this important post. It would do you some good to get firsthand knowledge regarding Iraq, a country in which the situation is said to be grave and deteriorating. The fifth post. What a magnificent, terrifically boring and irrelevant blog. Honestly, who on earth cares what you have to say? The sixth post. You left Congress disgracefully and you want people to take you seriously? You should be in prison, you clown. And then blank off, Tom. I mean, just going right through the list. This is TomDeLay.com. Didn't we already stick a fork in your butt and decide you're done? To paraphrase you, you were the federal government. Now you're a nothing. The fact that you're trying to keep your name alive by starting a stupid blog is actually kind of pathetic and sad. Please just go away. This is just the order in which they came in. He opens it up to the public and the public posts. Here's the next one. You wouldn't know honesty if it came up and bit you in the butt. And here's the next one. How pathetic you are, Mr. DeLay. You are a criminal, and you should be serving time in jail along with your buddies Ashcroft and Cunningham. The damage you've done to this country is reprehensible. Do us all a favor and just disappear, you sorry excuse for a person. Here's the next one. Tom DeLay, when you're locked up, will you smuggle blog posts out in your visitors' bodily orifices? The next post, you sleazebag. I mean, this is it just goes on and on and on like this. Oh, and then there's, you know, a response from Tom DeLay. Oh, screw all you critics. I was the best leader the House of Representatives ever had. Don't try to smear me. I'm the definition of honesty and integrity, so screw all you liberal commies. The language is actually a little more colorful than that, and it's signed Tom DeLay, but I doubt it. Here's the next one. Follow this. Forget the blog, Tom. Just hook up with OJ and write a book. Yeah. So anyway, 75 minutes. This thing was open. And this goes on. What I just shared with you is like two pages. It goes on for 10, 12 pages. And most of them are just, you know, quite, you know, people saying they're dismayed? Or people saying they're horrified? Or people saying, you know, is this real? Can this be a joke? Anyhow, Jack in Reseda, California on the line. Our number 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
How you doing? It sounds like delay is checking jury pools or something.
Maybe that's it.
But anyway, just in light of what you were just saying about Cheney, Rumsfeld, and all those guys, which, by the way, was great to hear somebody talking about that, even on Air America, just about the way that this whole thing came about, the position we're in now. I just think that we're at a time in the history right now where we can turn this around in a big way, but I don't think it's just going to be by raising the minimum wage a few bucks or you know, telling these guys they just screwed up. I think we really got to nail them, and I'm disappointed in Conyers and Waxman and all these people that should just be not doing something for revenge, but just going in and nailing these guys.
Jack, they're going to. They will not have the power to subpoena a single witness until, what, the 5th or the 7th of January, whatever the date is, you know, as soon as Congress comes back into session. And they are going to. There is absolutely no doubt about it that they're going to start holding the hearings. And when the hearings are held, and in fact, in advance of that, Cheney has already said he's going to refuse any subpoenas from Congress. I mean, he has already set up a constitutional crisis. He said he's going to do like Nixon did, say, no, I'm sorry, you know, we've got we've got separation of power here. We've got executive privilege. I mean, they're already setting this up. Bush and Cheney have both already hired criminal defense attorneys. They are anticipating all this stuff. But my point is, and I think the point that you called originally to speak to about this, is that the United States is at a point right now where we are in the last gasps of what Charles Durbin refers to as the third corporate regime. We had the era of the robber barons in the late 1800s. We had the period leading up to the Republican Great Depression, the Roaring Twenties, and now from 1980, the Reagan Revolution, from 1980 to today, this third time that we've come dangerously close to fascism. Fascism being defined as the merger of corporation and state interests, and we will either flip into a more corporatistic, more fascistic state, and that's certainly the direction the Bushies are pushing us, or we will re-embrace the traditional values that this country was founded on, the ideals that are embodied in the Bill of Rights. We've already lost habeas corpus. We've got to get it back. I mean, it's just fundamental stuff like that, and re-embrace the idea that government is us. And that the reason that we get together to form government is to assist and protect us from the predators among us and from the dangers out there. It's the reason why we have fire departments. It's why we tax ourselves and create these things. Why we create police departments. Why we have public education so that we can have social mobility, so that we can all have an opportunity to have the American dream. And on and on I could go with the list. But the bottom line is we're going to move in one direction or the other. We're not going to stay where we are. And I think the only thing, or the main thing, that will cause us to move in a progressive direction is if we wake up enough people. And it's not going to happen from the top down. It never has. It never will. It's going to happen from the bottom up. It's you, Jack, and me, and all the rest of us out there, the middle class of America, saying to the middle class of America, hey, time to wake up. These people are taking us for a ride.
I have one comment that, The first thing that Pelosi and everybody did when they got elected said, oh no, we're not going to impeach this guy. And to me, that's kind of scary.
Now, well, there was a caveat in there.
But I feel like what Bush said, you're either with us or you're against it.
Yeah. It's not that black and white. Jack, if they had said we are going to impeach him, that would be just like somebody, you know, it would be just like Bush standing up and saying, we need to execute this guy. We're convinced he committed a crime when a trial hadn't been held yet. I mean,
I hope you're right, and I really appreciate what you're saying out
Thanks,
there.
Jack. I really and truly believe that I am. I mean, time will tell, and I hope I'm right. But I believe that we're going to, and I've had John Conyers on this program at least a half a dozen times, and we've had this conversation. They're going to do the investigations, and the outcome is going to be just absolutely obvious. 16 minutes past the hour.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss. It just don't get any better than this.
And
Welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good.
It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat up at the top of the page and hang out with some of the finest minds in the entire internet. Rick in San Pedro, California. Hey, Rick, you have the answer to our question from the first hour, I believe, about what is the correct quote?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be on. Thank you. You know, the passage, the way it reads, is from Luke chapter 2. It's the announcement of the angels to the shepherds out in the field
about
the birth of Jesus. And the way most of us are used to it is glory to God in the highest and on earth peace, goodwill toward men, which is, of course, from the old King James. Most modern translations now say glory to God in the highest and on earth peace toward people of goodwill. And the reason for the difference is that we now work from a more ancient Greek text than the King James translators have.
We're back to the Quella document now.
Right, right. We're going back to almost 1,000 years in the Greek. And so, and also the word anthropoi is used there, which is not a male gender exclusive term. It's actually a gender inclusive term. And so people, as opposed to men, is a better use of...
And isn't that statement itself a paraphrasing of a phrase out of Isaiah?
Yeah, actually it is. It goes back to Isaiah chapter 57.
Yeah.
And I don't have that right in front of me, but I could look it up here real fast, I suppose. But it's a reference. Let's see, I'm digging through it.
That's okay, Rick. I don't want to turn the show into a discursion on theology. But
gotcha.
It's good to know, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the heads up and for the factoid there.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Anyway, okay. I heard that. I thought you might like to hear from a not so fundamentalist priest. So
you're a priest. Well, thank you very much for listening and for sharing your insight with us, Rick.
Father, you're
Rick.
Very welcome. Take care.
Thanks. You too. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, a certain radio host had Barack Obama on yesterday, and he asked his audience before he came on to ask questions that he could then ask the senator. And why doesn't somebody in progressive talk ask the one question that every progressive wants to know of every presidential contender, down from Dennis Kucinich to Al Sharpton and whoever goes for it? And the question is, do you believe that agents of the Bush administration planned, executed, supported, or covered up any aspect of the 9/11 attacks?
Right, and the critical word there is or, because the answer from anybody in the United States who has any intelligence at all should be yes. If the answer, you know, if the word or is in there, if the word and was in there, then you'd say, well, I don't know. You know, I mean, you know, because the...
But it's a discussion, I think, that needs to be out in the open. Too many...
Yeah, the investigation has not been done. The 9/11 Commission was the most watered down, you know, half-hearted effort, or, you know, you can characterize it even a little more stridently than that, I suppose.
It was a deceit. I mean, Kane and Hamilton have admitted that the administration lied to them on repeated occasions.
Yeah, but yes, and Bush, you know, would not testify unless Cheney could go there and hold his hand, and they refused to testify under oath. And the ground rules said that whenever Bush was speaking, Cheney was not allowed to drink water, and that's a joke. I agree with you, Jeff. This is one that's going to come back to haunt a lot of folks, and again, hopefully, with the Democrats in control of Congress, there'll be some kind of an investigation on that. The one I'd like to see a serious investigation on is the anthrax attacks, because that's the one that really, you know, 9/11 really stinks huge. And the anthrax attacks stink even worse. I mean, you, with regard to 9/11, you've got this very bizarre statement that Bush made. You know, that nobody saw the first plane, right? Nobody saw the first plane. The first plane was... Because it was more than 24 hours later before some tourist video appeared. All that everybody saw was the second plane, because after the first plane hit, all the news cameras pointed at the two towers, and then we saw the video of the second plane hitting. Here's George Bush lying about it.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom. talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
Now, some folks have taken Bush's own statement that he watched the first plane hit the tower when nobody else in America watched the first plane hit the tower as evidence of some kind of conspiracy. I take it as evidence of being a pathological liar. But you can choose. I mean, either one is possible. Yes. We'll be back. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM. 866-440-8466. Drop by our live chat room, TomHartmann.com. I'll be hanging out there during the break. 27 minutes past the hour.
I've been working on vacation, chasing hares and moles. Cindy, she had notwithstanding, and I never read the polls. What's the point? I've made no mistakes I know of. That's just not like me. I subscribe to presidential infallibility. Intelligent design, the notion seems divine. Science must be wrong, wrong, wrong. The world's initial phase took place in 7 days. I knew it all along. I read the Bible.
And next welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. One of the folks in the chat room, Fawn, in the chat room, actually saw the first plane hit the World Trade Center. This you know, proves the old thing about if you've got, 40 people in a room, two people will have the same birthday. It's like, you know, the statistical probabilities are always weirder than you think. Fawn just happened to be in New York City. Said she was, you know, leaning against a building having a cigarette when she looked up and saw the first plane hit the first tower. I don't believe that Bush did, but in any case. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Just got a quick questions here. One, in the second hour, you were talking about with the guy that wrote the book. And my question regarding that info basically is, with all these corporations that have merged and bought basically everything that the United States ever had, including our municipalities and leasing our tollways.
And those being foreign companies, by the way, doing that. The major company out here in Oregon that's buying our roads and turning them into tollways is a company based in France. I mean, there's a company based in Spain that's doing much of it around the United States.
Yes, and what can be done about that? And also my second question is, if this Department of Faith-Based Initiatives is a government office, I'm assuming, that we the taxpayers are paying for, where is the separation of church and state?
Okay, two separate issues. The first one is, as long as we are buying $800 billion a year more from the rest of the world than we are selling to the rest of the world ends up with $800 billion a year that they have to spend somehow here in the United States. Since they don't want to buy stuff that we make here, because we don't make stuff here anymore, because of the insane trade policies that Tom Friedman and Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush have promoted, because we don't make anything anymore, they are instead buying us. They're buying our companies. They're buying our property. They're buying our buildings. They're buying our, you know, $1,697,433,000,000 worth of American companies have been sold since Reagan started this process in 1983. A total of 13,730 companies. You want to see a great detail of it, go to economyandcrisis.org. The only way to stop all these foreign companies from coming here to the United States and buying up the United States is to stop buying more from the rest of the world than we sell to the rest of the world. And that means to walk away from all these insane trade policies, these so-called treaties or trade agreements, GATT, NAFTA, CAFTA, you know, AFTA, the whole bunch of them, and go back to the kind of system, the kind of trade system that we had in the United States from our founding up until the 1980s and 1990s, where we have a tariff system where we say, you know, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in the United States and you want to make that pair of shoes in Hong Kong where you can do it with 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine. We can't stop you. But when you import them, you're going to pay a 90-cent tariff import tax on that pair of shoes. And so it's going to cost you a dollar no matter where you make them. You might as well make them here. And that's the only reason that three-quarters of the industries in America have survived the last 200 years is because we protected them. And every country, not every country in the world, but most of the countries in the world do exactly that. China is actually one of the most aggressive at doing that, at using tariffs and other kinds of protectionist measures to protect their own domestic industries. Japan is incredibly efficient at it. Taiwan does it. Korea does it. You know, the list goes on and on. Countries all over Europe do it. And we stopped doing it because we drank the Tom Friedman Kool-Aid, and thus we end up broken in debt to these countries, and so they come over and they buy us up. We used to be, when Ronald Reagan came into office in 1980, we were the world's largest creditor. More countries and, you know, more entities in other countries owed us money than any other nation in literally in the history of the world. We were the banker to the world. And we were, and we had, now some would argue this is a bad thing. And I can make that argument. It's semi-imperialist status, as it were. But, and we Americans, American companies, owned companies and land in countries all around the world. We were the biggest creditor in the world. We are now, 26 years later, after 26 years of this insanity, we are now the largest debtor in the world. We are even in debt to Mexico. And so, you know, that's the bottom line on that. With regard to your second question, the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives was not passed by Congress. It is not legal. It was created by executive fiat. It was created by the stroke of a pen by George W. Bush in order to transfer money to quote, faith-based organizations, end quote, so that they could campaign for Republicans. In the 2004 election cycle, in the 12 months leading up to the November election of 2004, over $1 billion of your and my taxpayers' money was taken from us by force and handed to these nonprofit organizations, and the product, the result of that was this enormous outpouring of Republican support from the churches. In fact, they put a lot of this money into the African American community, and they succeeded in doubling from 5% to 10% the number of African Americans who voted Republican, and all of them can be tracked back to black churches that were given faith-based money. Answer your question?
Yeah, what can we do about it? I mean, can they be held accountable for that?
They can. With regard to the trade stuff, we just need to start electing members of Congress who get it. You know, Byron Dorgan gets it. Bernie Sanders gets it. Even on the Republican side, Ron Paul, you know, probably the most conservative member of Congress, gets it. We need to be electing people who understand that our trade policies are suicidal, number one. And with regard to this Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, Congress, again, we the people, we need to be hassling our elected representatives and saying, do something about this. This is wrong. We think that it's important enough. You know, religion is an important enough part of the life, the mainstream and life of America, that we are going to subsidize it by saying that they don't have to pay taxes. But no more than that. No more than that. In fact, the deal that we made with them is we will exempt you from taxes if you will exempt yourself from political activity, because political activity can be used to further exempt yourself from taxes, and that's just something that shouldn't work. And so, anyhow, pardon the long rant, John. You asked me what time it was. I told you how to build a watch, but that's my take on it.
No, I really appreciate it because it really opens, you know, light up on a lot of issues, and, there's just so many things that...
Yeah.
I don't know that the Democrats are going to be able to do everything they need to do in the short time they have.
Yeah, no. Well, it's going to take a lot of work, but they know how to chew gum and walk at the same time. So the main thing is, though, that we have to be supporting the progressive Democrats and discouraging the Rahm Emanuels, the anti-progressive, the conservative Democrats. John, thanks a lot for the call. Garrett in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Garrett.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you what you think is going to happen to the economy next year. There's a lot of angles to this, but basically I'm a liberal activist. I read Chomsky, Nader, I listen to you. The list goes on and on and on. But I work with a lot of capitalist pigs, and a lot of them make a lot of good arguments. And I'm concerned about, you know, are we going to have to start paying for this make-believe economy?
We already are. We're paying $350-370 billion in taxes this year just to pay interest on the national debt, on that portion of the national debt that was run up by Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 3, Bush 2.
Right. Do you think, like, stocks are going to go down, interest rates are going to go up, things like that?
Yeah, my personal expectation, and I don't present myself as an economist, and I've been real wrong before. I mean, back in the 70s, I bought gold at 700, you know. But my personal expectation is that we are going to see a major deflation of the value of the dollar internationally. That is to say, the price of gold, the price of copper, the price of oil, other commodities are going to go up. The dollar is going to decline in value, particularly relative to the Swiss franc and the British pound sterling and the euro. And, you know, I'm not so sure about the Canadian dollar. I used to think so. Look at Warren Buffett. He's moving all of his investments into securities that are denominated in these other currencies, number one. Yeah. Number two, therefore, pretty much regardless of what happens to the stock market, I mean, if the value is becoming worth less, of course, the stock market will go up, but it'll be phony increases. I expect that all these commodity prices are going to go up. And I'm expecting, you know, frankly, that we're going to see real significant inflation because they stopped publishing M3 in March, you know, the tune to which they're inflating the currency. They did that. The only possible reason I can come up with why they stopped publishing M3 is that they're going to try and inflate their way out of debt. This government is so in debt that they're going to do the Weimar Republic strategy of paying off debt with deflated currency or, you know, inflated currency, deflated value. And so we're going to see inflation. Interest rates will probably track that. That's a trend I'm expecting over the next couple of years. What to do about that, I honestly don't know. As I said, I'm not an investment advisor and I'm not a real rich guy, so I can't tell you, you know, here's what to do or how to do it. Garrett, thanks for the call. John in Hollywood. John, we have just a few seconds left before we've got to take a break. A quick one?
Yes, I'd like to disagree respectfully with your choice of fascism or populism for the future, because I think that we already have a kinder, gentler type of fascism right now. The corporate authoritarianism that which we see all the time is an anti-democratic.
I agree with
fascism.
You. I agree with you. I agree with you, and I'll call it fascism too. I'll agree. I will. Right up front. Yep, you're right. 45 minutes. Thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels.
Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, over in the chat room, Sue asks, how's David Tebow? David is the, what's his title, executive director, something like that, editor, senior editor over at the conservative Cybercast News Service, CNS News, and he comes on the program regularly to debate issues with me. Today, at the beginning of the program, the first hour, he was supposed to be on to debate global warming. David is suffering from leukemia, the consequence of radiation treatment for cancer therapy, and last night had to be rushed to the hospital for a blood infection. And so please keep David Tebow, even though he's politically on the other side, he's a good guy. Keep him in your prayers or your good thoughts or however you personally do that. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, so quick news from Washington, and then let's take a few more calls together, eh?
Quick news from Washington. The president met with Al Hashimi, who is the vice president of Iran today. Presumably they talked about the situation in Iran, which is, Tom, you'll be surprised to hear this is bad.
Wait a minute. Our president met with the vice president of Iran with an N?
Oh, sorry, Iraq.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Sorry, I was sitting here reading an article about Iran.
Yeah, okay.
Reading about the Holocaust conference.
Yeah, which is absolutely bizarre.
It's beyond.
But that's a whole other discussion. It's beyond the pale.
Absolutely. So he met with the vice president of Iraq to discuss the situation in Iraq, which is bad. So that's going on, and he's continuing his listening. He's in listening mode, we were told by the Deputy White House Press Secretary this morning, which I found a little disconcerting because I wondered, if he's not in listening mode, what does that mean he's in? If he has to specifically be in listening mode.
Well, I don't think he has a thinking mode. He has the listening mode and the speaking mode, but there's not the pondering mode. By the way, just this Holocaust conference that Iran is holding, where they're bringing in these Holocaust deniers, these whack jobs who are saying that, you know, that it didn't happen and it was all made up, and it's, you know, like the moon landing was actually on a Hollywood set in Arizona. The one good thing that might come out of that, and it's a might, and I frankly doubt it will, but the one thing, good thing that might come out of that is that what is being said out loud in Iran right now, and I can tell you this from having traveled in the Middle East over the last 30 years a fair amount, what is being said out loud in Iran right now is widely believed across much of the Middle East anyway. And hopefully, by having a public discussion of it, Ahmadinejad might actually cause people to realize that the Holocaust actually did happen. So we'll see.
That's a very valid point.
Because it's not like he's saying anything that probably 70-80% of the citizens of, for example, Saudi Arabia already believe. I mean, they already believe it. The whole thing was just made up. And that's, you know, conventional wisdom in much of the Arab world, tragically. And so anyhow. Let's pick up a few phone calls here. Matt in Oakland, California, you're live with me and Victoria Jones, an actual accredited White House correspondent in Washington, D.C.
Is that me?
Hey, Matt.
Hi. I had a question, actually, about kind of the nature of representative democracy. Specifically, I was wondering kind of what general responsibility, legal or otherwise, committee heads or members of committees serving Congress have to people who are, you know, outside the voting districts.
In other words, if you call or contract your congressman or congresswoman, your elected representative, on your behalf as your local person, that makes sense. But if you're contacting somebody who doesn't represent you but is the head of a committee, do they theoretically represent more than just their own district? Victoria?
Right. I think it's true that they take an oath to uphold the Constitution.
Sure.
Beyond that.
My sense of it is that people who are committee heads think of themselves as serving a larger constituency than just their district. Is that your experience, Victoria?
That's my experience, too. Well, if you're on a committee, you see yourself as really serving the country.
Okay. Eleanor in Blue Lake, California. Hey, Eleanor.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy to talk with you. I'm a little nervous, too, because... But anyhow, I'm reading your book on ADHD. Fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Well, you know, back in the August of 2004... I heard a news item, CBS 6 o'clock news,
mm-hmm.
and it was about a committee in Washington, D.C., trying to determine how to penalize Senator Shelby because he gave some pre-9/11 information to Fox Network.
This was the Able Danger thing, wasn't it?
Gee, I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know, but let me go further. He was giving information to Fox, just what it was, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And this was against an executive gag order imposed on both houses in October of 2002.
Do you know about that, Victoria?
I don't know anything about it. I'm fascinated to be listening to it.
Will you dig into that on our behalf and let us know?
I'll see what I can find out.
Okay, Eleanor.
A friend of mine heard it on Nightline.
Yeah, we'll try and track it down, Eleanor. And David will poke around here on the Internet as well. We'll see what we can come up with. Okay. Andra in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah, we have a minute to go. What's up?
Actually, I'm sorry, this is a little off topic, but a long time ago you used to have a segment where you would talk about certain psychological things that you had learned about how to reorganize the memory.
Yeah, NLP and stuff. We're starting that the last segment of every Friday again. We started it last week.
I'm sorry, what was it called?
Neuro-linguistic programming, NLP.
And do you have a name or a book that I could check out?
I have a new book out called Walking Your Blues Away, which is about that broadly. It's not political. It's entirely about psychotherapy. You may find it useful. So if you just go to tomhartman.com, you can find it there. Andrew, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. You're the last caller here. We just have a few seconds left.
Dan?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Listen, two things. First of all, I wish that all the politicians
would leave their thought of legacy at the door.
Yeah, well said, Dan. And off they go. Victoria, but thanks for the call. Victoria Jones, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
TalkRadioNews.com, the Talk Radio News Service. Tomorrow, conservative Andrew Bernstein and I will be taking opposite sides of the question on New York City's ban on trans fats. And in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Connor O'Shaughnessy says he knows how to spot a lying politician before he gets your vote. Oh, yeah? Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.